This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The Torah faces an interesting problem in trying to deal with human beings, and that is its inability, as we've discussed previously, to legislate feelings. That even when the Torah tells people to love one another, the Ramban points out that can't really mean to love one another, because you can't tell people to love one another. V'ahavta l'racha kamocha doesn't mean you must love each other. That's not possible. The Torah can't legislate feelings. The Torah can't legislate the internal. The internal has to be achieved by the human being himself. And yet the Torah is very specific as to what kind of internals it wants for us. So how is the Torah to give us the outline of what we're meant to be feeling without legislating feelings? The most absurd thing would be if the Torah started telling us how we're supposed to feel in every situation. And so the Torah opts for legislating the kind of action that would result if we felt in a particular way, in order to create for us an environment and a structure that enables us, if we study it, to understand what kind of feelings we're meant to build up in ourselves, what kind of feelings we're meant to nurture for ourselves. One of the examples where we see that most clearly is in the question of this time of the year, where we're dealing with a time of mourning, a time of Avelus for Yerushalayim and for the Beis Hamikdash, for the temple as it used to be. And what's most important in a time of Avelus is not to go through the motions of mourning, but to experience the lack, to experience the loss. That's really what Avelus is all about, to experience the loss. And how can you legislate that? How can you tell people, feel the loss, you shall feel the loss, you shall suffer when you think of the loss? It's virtually impossible, it is impossible, and it would be ridiculous. The Torah doesn't attempt to legislate the feeling. Instead, the Torah describes a whole system and process, a 3-week process, that we would feel, that we would act out if we felt the way we're supposed to feel. And at least by creating that structure, we have some kind of idea of what we're supposed to be feeling, and at least we have some kind of idea if there's a gap in the feelings we're meant to be experiencing. But if that wouldn't be the case, then there wouldn't be any kind of understanding of how we're meant to relate emotionally to this particular time of the year, and it would disappear. We would lose the emotion totally. Similar to the laws of Avelus in general, the whole process of mourning is not one designed only to assist the mourner in coping with his loss, which it happens to do exceptionally well. Actually, assist the Ovel in dealing with his loss in the psychologically most sophisticated and perfect way possible. That's not the purpose of the laws of Avelus. The purpose of the laws of Avelus is to outline the kind of process that one would undergo if one's feelings were what they were meant to be. And that process, in the case of a parent, for example, lasts 11 months. And it's meant to last 11 months because there's meant to be a feeling, and one has to actually measure, in a sense, the gap between what one's feeling and what one's acting, and the way one's acting, and correct the feeling to fit the action. That really is the issue. Are we going to leave feelings to the individual and then allow him to express those feelings in action? Or are we going to set certain standards of action and encourage the human being to develop the feelings to be able to justify, to be integrated with those actions? And the Torah opts for the latter. The Torah says if we leave people to feel whatever they want to, the ability of the human being to really reach great heights of feelings for things beyond himself, to feel things that affect you, that's easy. To feel pain and suffering that affects you directly, that's easy. But to feel, to experience feelings of things beyond the human being, beyond the limits of the human being, that wouldn't be possible unless the Torah actually gave us instruction and says, this is the way you would be acting if you felt the way you're supposed to be feeling. Now go and figure out what to do about it. And this time of the year, more than anything, is a time where we should be focusing on the gap between our feelings and our actions. So from tonight, we don't eat meat for a week. Fine, so we won't eat meat for the week. The 9 days have started. What feeling is there inside us that justifies that action? Why aren't we? So if we said to ourselves, why aren't we eating meat? The answer would be, some might answer because the Shulchan Aruch says you mustn't. And those who really very much more advanced would say because we're mourning the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And you then change the subject and you carry on talking about all sorts of irrelevancies and laughing at all sorts of funny things and you carry on life as normal. So there's such incongruency in the way we operate. Life is normal, but we won't touch meat. Why aren't we touching it? Because we're in mourning. Don't you know we're in mourning? But there's nothing about us that really is in any kind of mourning. And so we create, in a time like this, we realize perhaps more than any the enormous gap between the way we're feeling and the way we're acting that actually almost makes our actions look ludicrous. Not almost make our actions look ludicrous. It does make our actions look ludicrous. So the question is, so why do we keep the actions? And again, this is our dilemma. So do we say, well, I don't really feel for the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, so I won't carry out the charade. I won't do that. No, I don't want to be hypocritical. The Torah doesn't recommend that route. Because if that will happen, you'll never develop the feeling for the loss of the Beis HaMikdash. Rather, notice the incongruity and focus on bridging the gap, not by minimizing the actions, but by increasing the feelings. That's what's supposed to happen. The idea is that the structure is in place, you identify the gap, and you develop the feeling that you need in order to fill the gap. But unfortunately, that doesn't very often happen. And the same applies with nearly every area of halacha. Every part of halacha is structural. It has to be. It would be ridiculous if the Torah tried to structure feelings. The Torah structures actions. Leaves the human being to question the gap between his feeling and his actions and to bridge that gap by elevating his feelings. That's how human growth takes place. That's how the human being is able to elevate his internal to levels of godliness. God describes the godly structure and says, now fill it. Get yourself there. Get to that point of feeling. But we don't usually do it. And I find this time of the year is perhaps not fortuitously a time that precedes the month of Elul and afterwards leading up to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, because this experience is the most important in the whole process of personal upliftment, to notice the gap between what we are doing and what we're doing with conviction. I'm not even talking about doing things just for no reason at all. We do it with serious conviction, and yet there isn't really the feeling for it. There's a beautiful interaction recorded in the Gemara in Bava Basra Daf Samach, where a brisa is brought, Kishechorov Habayis Bishniyah, when the second temple was destroyed, Rabu Purushim Bi Yisrael, there were a lot of frum people in Yisrael, really meticulous people, Sheloi Lechol Boso V'Sheloi Lishtus Yain, and they became permanently vegetarian and teetotalers. They wouldn't touch wine and they wouldn't touch meat. Nitpal Lohem Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Yeshua came across there, Omar Lohem, and he said to them, Bonai, my children, Mipnei Ma Iyatem Oichlim Boso, why aren't you eating meat? And why aren't you drinking wine? Omru lo, they said to him, Noichal boso shememenu makrivim agavi mizbeach v'akshav batel. Are you serious, Rabbi Yeshua? Are you suggesting that we should be eating meat, that same meat that used to be brought on the mizbeach, on the altar, in the temple, and that's all been destroyed, that's gone, and you expect us to sit and to eat meat as if nothing's happened? Nishti yayin shemenaschin agabi amizbeach v'akshav batel. And wine used to be brought on the altar in the Beis HaMikdash. We lived through that. We saw it. It's not as if it's history. We saw it. We saw what the Beis HaMikdash was. We saw the quality of life. We saw the moral standards. We saw the religious standards of the nation. We saw all that. And that's gone. Do you expect us to carry on drinking wine in the same way that we used to? Amalem, he said, interesting. In Cain, lechem lo noichol shekvar bitlu menochis. Well, then he says, it's interesting, but you know, we used to bring flour offerings too, so we should cut out bread as well. So let's cut out meat and wine and bread. Efshar b'feiras, they said, yeah, quite good, you're quite right. Yeah, we should stop eating bread, we should only eat fruit. He says, to peiras lo noichal shekvar bitlu bikurim. He said, how can you eat fruit? There used to be a fruit offering in the temple, and that's now gone, so you should stop eating fruit as well. Maim lo nishte, we should stop drinking water, shekvar botel nisu chamayim. We should stop drinking water, because we used to bring water at certain times in the Beis HaMikdash, also on the altar. Now the Beis HaMikdash is gone, so stop eating bread and fruit and wine and meat and water. Just die, give up life. Shosku, they kept quiet, they couldn't answer. Amar lahem bonai, he explained to them, Boyu v'omar lochem, I'll explain to you, he said to them, Sheloi lehisabel kol ikar iefsha. Not to mourn at all would be, it's impossible, can't be. Shekva nigzor o gzeiro. It's been decreed, we've got to do it. The temple's been destroyed and we mourn. Ula hisabel yosei medai iefsha, but to mourn too much is also not possible. She'en gozim gzeira ala tzibur elam kein rov tzibur yecholi la'amid bo. Because you don't make a decree on the community unless most of the people can keep to it. Not only, as we learned in the Gemara Shir, not only is it unwise to make a decree on the community that the community that is above their ability to keep, it's just not practical for them. Not only is it unwise, but it's prohibited. One isn't permitted to legislate a decree which the majority of the people are unable to keep. And therefore, we drink water and we eat wine and we drink wine and we eat meat. We just do what we're told not to do. So the levels are clearly defined. What are those levels of continuous mourning for the destruction? Kachamru Chachomim. So the Chachomim have said, Sod Odom is Beisu Besid. You can plaster your houses and you can paint them beautifully. Umeshayir Boy Dovar Muat. Just keep a little place that's unplastered. If you're building a new house, keep a little corner that's unplastered to remind you that although your house is complete, the house of God isn't. We don't have a Beis HaMikdash. So you keep a little place, an amo by an amo, 1 cubit by 1 cubit that you see, and that reminds you of the incompletion. But the rest of the house you complete, and it should be pleasant and nice. Oise Odom Kol Tzorchei Su'udo. Prepare for yourselves beautiful meals. There's no reason not to have a beautiful meal. Umeshayir Dovar Muat. Leave something out, leave a little bit on your plate when you're finished to remind you that the world is not complete. In other words, retain the consciousness, little reminders, but you can't introduce an oppressiveness into your day-to-day life. Yes, the temple's gone and that's very serious, and that means continuous reminder that things are incomplete, but do it in quiet ways, do it in ways that only you notice, that only you see, in order to remind you that that's the case. But what's interesting here is that it's the only reason that we don't fast permanently is because it's not practical, because most people couldn't stick to it. The level of mourning that is required emotionally is far beyond what has been legislated. And that's what Rabbi Yeshua says to them. Really, you're right. Theoretically, you're right. You shouldn't eat meat. You shouldn't drink wine. But then take it to its logical conclusion and stop eating fruit, bread, drinking water. In other words, fast permanently. And the only reason we don't do that is because that's not a practical decree. So they decreed what was practical. More than that, we're not permitted to keep. Which means Tisha B'Av is a sample of what life ought to be. Tisha B'Av is not just a day of the year. Tisha B'Av is actually a sample of what life ought to be without the Beis HaMikdash. Of what an incomplete life really ought to be. But the Beis HaMikdash is our justification for being able to engage fully in the business of life. In the time of the Beis HaMikdash, there is no restriction other than the pure halachic restrictions. There is no restriction in our celebration of life and the gifts that life has to offer. But in the absence of the Beis HaMikdash, when spiritual and moral life is not complete, there has to be some kind of reflection of that in the way we conduct ourselves day to day. But the real thing should be the level of awareness would be one. If we were really to develop the feeling of loss, the feeling of loss should be one, theoretically, of total withdrawal. That's not the way the Torah wants it, so it's done differently. But that's what Tisha B'Av is. Tisha B'Av shouldn't be seen as one day in the year in which you fast. Tisha B'Av should be seen as one day in the year in which we feel the way we're really meant to feel all the time. But it's not possible to feel that way all the time. It would be negative and destructive to feel that way all the time. And the Torah doesn't want us to feel that way all the time. But if our feelings were left to ourselves, in a sense, Tisha B'Av we should see as a sample of the way we're meant to feel all the time in the absence of the Beis HaMikdash. And what is that feeling? What is it that we're really mourning? And what is the nature of the experience of Tisha B'Av? It goes beyond the loss of the temple, the loss of the Beis HaMikdash. That's something difficult for us to relate to, because we don't fully understand what life was when the Beis HaMikdash was built and being used. There's the lovely pasuk in Chagiga Daf Hei that Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz brings often. Rebbe have a nakit sefer kinnis because kari begave. Rebbe was reading in the sefer kinnis. It must have been on Tisha B'Av. Ki matal lahay psuko. He came to a pasuk. He came to a verse in Eicha where it says hishlich mishomayim eretz, that the Ribbono Shel'Olam threw Yerushalayim and the glory of the Jewish people from the heaven to the earth. He cast it down. At that point, Nofar Minyode, the book fell out of his hand. It slipped out of his hand. Omar, and he said, "Me igro ram lebira amikta," from such heights to such depths. That was his comment. And Rav Chaim Shmulevitz used to ask, what's the fact that the book fell out of his hand got to do with the whole story? He reads a pasuk, the verse says, from such heights to such lows, the book falls out of his hands, and he says, "Ah, look what happened." He explains Rav Chaim Shmulevitz, he noticed when the book fell on the floor that it didn't make any difference to the book where it was. If the book's on the table, or the book's on a chair, or the book's on a bookshelf, or the book's on the floor, it doesn't make any difference to the book. What he did notice was that the fall damaged the book. A book gets damaged not by where it is, but by how far it's fallen. And from that, Reb Chaim Shmulevitz develops a whole shmuz on the concept of the damage caused to people by the fall. And it doesn't matter if you fall from level 100 to level 80, you're worse off than if you're standing on level 20, because you've fallen. And the fall itself is destructive. The fall itself hurts. The fall itself damages. And what Rebbe understood In this pasuk was, on Tisha B'Av we don't mourn the fact that we don't have a Beis HaMikdash. That's not what we mourn. We mourn the drop. We mourn the loss. We mourn the damage caused by the loss of dignity, the damage caused by the lowering of status, the comparison between what was and what is, what used to be and what is now and what could have been. That's what we're mourning. It's the gap that we're mourning. It's the fall that we're mourning. It's not the fact. That we're living quite nicely without a Beis HaMikdash. What's there to mourn about? Jewish people are doing quite well all over the world. They're doing nicely. Yeshivas are springing up all over the place. Torah is being learned. Jews are affluent. Anti-Semitism isn't too bad. There haven't been major wars in place where lots of Jews live for a long time. We're doing quite well. It's quite hard to mourn. What are we mourning about? We've got Eretz Yisrael back. We've got the state of Israel at least. We've got Eretz Yisrael back. We've got Jerusalem. Don't know how long they'll leave it with us, as we discussed last week, but meanwhile we've got it. What's there to mourn about? Says Rebbe, we mourn about the drop. That's what we have to be able to perceive. The fact that there's been a drop and the damage that that drop has caused. Without an understanding of the damage of the drop, the repair process can't take place. If you look at yourself in your present state and you say, it's fine, I'm comfortable where I am, there's no way that the repair process can in fact take place. And again, I suggest that that's why it's not fortuitous that Tisha B'Av comes at this particular time of the year. Because a precondition for the process of build-up to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur is an acknowledgement that there has been a fall. If we assume that we're on the highest level we could possibly be, there's no reason for Elul, there's no reason for Rosh Hashanah, there's no reason for Yom Kippur, there's no reason for anything. The precondition for the whole process of reconstruction is an acknowledgement that we've fallen. And not that we are on a low level. We are on a low level might imply, yes, we're on a low level, but that's the maximum of our potential. So knowledge that we're on a low level is not sufficient. And knowledge that we're on a low level is cause for depression. To merely think, yeah, I'm a good for nothing, I'm nothing, look where I am, that's not the issue. The issue is it doesn't matter how good I am or how not good I am. What's important is I've come from high places. And the extension of that argument is if I've come from high places, I could get back to high places. And that's really what's important. To acknowledge where the Jewish people could be. That's what we mourn on Tisha B'Av. And if we go around, as people tend to do sometimes today, thinking that the Jewish people are doing just fine, and that the religious world is doing just fine, and that the Torah is doing just fine, then I suggest we cancel Tisha B'Av. What's the point of it? The whole idea of Tisha B'Av is to understand it isn't just fine. That where we should be is very, very far from where we are. Where the nation could be is very, very far from where the nation is. Where the standard of learning Torah, teaching Torah, and living Torah should be is very far from where it is. It's that acknowledgement which is at the core of the feeling of Yom Kippur, of Tisha B'Av. That's what we're mourning. We're looking at the Torah in its potential. We're looking at the system of what the Torah is. We're looking at the moral structure of the Torah. We're looking at the human being that the Torah wants there to exist. And we're looking at the human being that exists. We're looking at the level of leadership that the Torah designs, and we're looking at the level of leadership that actually exists. We're looking at the educational institutions that the Torah requires, and we're looking at the educational institutions that actually exist. That leads us into Tisha B'Av. That's what we're mourning. Not just the historical destruction of a building in Yerushalayim some 2,000 years ago. What we're looking at is that right now, the gap between what we could be and what we are is so vast that it brings one to a sense of mourning. Without that, the process of the 9 days and the process of Tisha B'Av is one that is totally meaningless. But it goes beyond that too. The Medrash says in Bereishis, Me Odom Harishun Hichnastiv L'Teich Gan Eden, in just the same way as I took the first man into the Garden of Eden, the Tzivisov, and I gave him one commandment, I instructed him, V'Ovarat Tzivuyi, and he disobeyed me, the Danti Yosei, B'Shiluchin V'Gerushin, and I expelled him from the Garden of Eden, the Konanti Olov Eicha, and I read Eicha, I went into mourning, says God, for Adam Harishon. When Adam fell, when Adam sinned that time, I went into mourning and I read Eicha. Hichnastiv L'Teich Gan Eden, and it brings Psuchim. And where does it say? How do we know that Hashem learned Eicha? Konanti Olov Eicha, Shenemar, as it says, Vayikro Hashem Elokim El Ha'odom, Vayom Eloi Ayeka. And God called to Adam and he said, where are you? But the word Ayeko is written, but Eichoksiv. If you look at the spelling of Eicho and the spelling of Ayeko, it's the same word. In the same way, says the Medrash, I brought my children into Eretz Israel, the Tzivisim, and I gave them instructions, the Ovroa Tzivui, and they disobeyed my instructions, Danti Oysom B'Shiluchim of Gerushin, I expelled them from Israel, the Konanti Alehim Eicho, and I cried over them with Eicha. So the connection between the word Eicha and Ayeko needs to be explored a little bit more. But the Medrash says that this national event, which sets off Tisha B'Av, the fact that God destroyed Yerushalayim and destroyed the Beis Hamikdash, and the result of that is Eicha, which we read on Tisha B'Av, is paralleled by and originated by a similar event that took place on the part of one human being. So we have a national and an individual occurrence that the Medrash parallels. What's the individual occurrence? There was an Adam Harishon, there was a first man. He sinned, and God calls to him, Vayikra Hashem Elokim El Ha'odom, and God calls out to man, Vayom Eloi, and he said to him, Ayeko, where are you? Which is a strange thing to say. Of course God knew where he was. So let's look a little bit at what led up to that event. The first thing that needs to be appreciated is who Adam Harishon was before the sin. So the Gemara says in Sanhedrin that Adam Harishon hayo misoifa olam bad soifa hayo min oretz ad larakia hayo. Adam Harishon, he extended from one end of the universe to the other. He extended from the earth up to the heavens. And clearly, that doesn't mean that he was a giant of unimaginable proportion. Not at all. What it means was simply that his capacity to have impact on the entire universe was almost limitless. There was no part of the world, there was no part of the universe that wasn't touched by Adam's intellect, by Adam's mind, by Adam's capacity to understand and to impact upon. There wasn't limitation, he was an unlimited human being. And we have no concept of the greatness of a human being, of what the human being is really capable of. Even after the sin, how much more so before the sin? The Gemara says, again, difficult Gemara to understand, but it gives us some indication as to what this man was. That angels used to cook his meals, and angels used to chill his wine. In other words, the whole of the upper reaches of heaven was there to serve him, like waiters. They were at his service. God's whole upper kingdom was at Adam's service. That's what it means. That was the stature of the human being. That was his quality. That was his potential. That's who he was at that time. And that's very difficult for us to understand because we're ingrained with the theory of evolution, which sees modern man as superior to ancient man. And that isn't so. If we take the theory of evolution back thousands of years, beyond 6,000 years, then maybe there was some kind of semi-animal at that time. But however you want to understand it, at the point that Adam was created, the point that the first man was created, he was the greatest human being that has ever lived. He was a human being that was so close to godliness that also Chazal tell us when the angels saw him, they wanted to say Kodesh, Kodesh, Kodesh. They started davening, they started praying to him. They confused him with God himself. He had such godliness about him, such limitlessness about him, such infinity about him, such total spirituality about him, that it was difficult to actually see that there was anything other than godliness in that human being. That's who Adam was. He chooses to eat from the Eitz Hadas. And the result of that, the Torah tells us, Vatipokachna enei shnehem, and the eyes of both of them are opened, Vayedu ki erumim hem, and the first thing they notice is that they're naked. This is a strange thing. You picture on the one hand that godliness, that enormous godliness, and what's the first thing after becoming wise as a result of eating from the one tree they were told not to eat from? They become aware that they're naked. Vayispiru alei te'eno. And they use fig leaves to sew. Vayasu lohem chagoyros. And they made for themselves belts. Now normally that's understood that they were totally naked before, and that they made for themselves some kind of clothing. But the Chizkuni brings bring a parish that isn't so at all, that it has to be translated literally exactly as it reads. And that's Vayasu lahem chagoris, they made belts. La chagoris hamalbush. They used to wear a tunic without a belt at the waist, and they've made a belt for themselves. What's the idea of the belt? That's like the Hasidim still put on a girdle before they daven, to separate, as the halacha actually requires, that there needs to be a separation between the upper part of the body and the lower part of the body. That was instituted at that point. Until that point, there was no separation between the upper part of the body and the lower part of the body. From that point on, that's what they became conscious about, that there was a separation. What does that mean? How do we understand that? Because herein lies the origin of Tisha B'Av. Herein lies the origin of the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash and everything that resulted from that. The upper part of the body symbolizes the intellect and the emotions. The lower part of the body symbolizes the instincts. And we know that it's said that before the time of eating from the Eitz Hadas, Adam didn't have a Yetzer Hara, he had no evil inclination, didn't desire to do evil. What does that mean, he didn't desire to do evil? What kind of a human being was he? What was the challenge of life in that situation? And it's explained that it's not that there wasn't a Yetzer Hara at all, but that the instinct and morality were so intertwined, so synthesized, that the choice to do wrong wasn't a choice. The example is given, everybody has a choice. There can be a cold winter's night and a beautiful raging fire in your lounge. You have the choice. If you're feeling really that cold, you have the choice to jump into the fire and to really warm yourself up. You have free choice. Nobody's stopping you from doing it. But it's not a choice. It's not something that enters your mind. The destructive potential of that action is so clear that it wouldn't enter your mind. You don't even have a desire to do it. It's non-existent. So with Adam HaRishon before the sin, his instinct, his intuition, and his moral consciousness was so synthesized that there was no desire to do wrong except the desire for knowledge. And that's why God knew the only thing he might tempt him with is with knowledge. Eitz Hadas. That's the only thing he might be tempted to overreach himself with. And that's where he went, and that's the direction he took. But having done so, he tipped the scale where he was previously a perfectly synthesized human being, where the passion and the intellect were perfectly balanced, where the instinct and the intuition on the one hand and the intellect on the other hand was perfectly balanced. That one little tilt in favor of instinct damaged the balance of the human being. And for the first time he realized after that there was an instinctive part of himself that had a will of its own. That the human being now has an instinct that operates, or that can operate, separately from the intellect. That he has an instinct that can operate separately from the emotion. That he has an emotion that can operate separately from the intellect. That integrity of the human being had been shattered. And it then became the challenge of mankind to try and recapture that total synthesis. To try and recapture that total integrity. That's what Adam shattered. And as a symbol of his nakedness, that means a consciousness of his nakedness. And that's why Rashi says, what does it mean they noticed that they were naked? Rashi says it's not that they were naked in the normal sense of the word. Do you have to have your eyes open to discover that you don't have any clothes on? Even a blind person knows when he's dressed and when he's not. What does it mean they noticed that they were naked? Mitzvah achas hoiso b'yodom. They only had one mitzvah. Then this artelu himeno, and they have become naked of that mitzvah. Says Rashi, that nakedness is a moral nakedness, a religious nakedness, not a physical nakedness. And therefore the dressing themselves with that girdle, the dressing of themselves with that belt, is a demonstration of the fact that that beautiful synthesis of the human body, that beautiful synthesis of the human being, which was responsible for its limitlessness, had been shattered. And that the human being had now had two separate parts, that each had wills of their own and could destroy the human being with the tensions and pressures that those two dynamics have. And that's symbolized by having to wear the girdle, by having to wear that belt, separating the top part of the body from the bottom part of the body. And in fact, we've often discussed that that's part of the symbol of the tefillin. And the tefillin is the opposite of the gatel. The tefillin tries to symbolize the resynthesizing of the different parts of the human being, or at least of the parts of the upper reaches of the human being, because even that synthesis has been shattered. And so the tefillin tries to bind together the intellect with the heart and with the practical side of the human being, that the things we do and the things we feel and the things we think should all have some kind of synthesis. At least that binding process should take place to create an integrated human being. Then he said, then the Torah tells us, they hear God's voice around the garden, they now become conscious of God, and there's a part of them that can't handle that. The intellect's quite happy to welcome the Ribbono Shel Olam, why not? The emotion's a little bit mixed, but the intuitive part is not so sure it wants God around. That's what changes. Whereas before the sin, the instinct also wanted God around. The instinct also wanted morality. Now the instinct part of the human being is not so sure that it wants God around. And Adam and his wife hid from God. In the trees of the garden, right into nature they went to try and hide, to try and find that synthesis, to try and find that integrity again, to get away from the external imposition of a godly system of values on an instinct which now had a will of its own and which was going wild, which they couldn't quite understand how to bring back into some kind of synthesized whole. At that point, Vayikra Hashem Elokim El Ha'odom, God calls to man, Vayomelo, and says to him, Ayeko, where are you? Look at where you are. And that question is the first moral questioning that God puts to mankind. Just look at where you are, where you were, and where you are. Look at the journey you've taken. Look at where you've come from and look at where you are, because only then can the healing process start. So it's not just a question of saying, Adam, where are you? I'm looking for you. That's not the issue. It's, Adam, where are you? You're not where I left you last. Are you asking yourself where you are? That's really what it is. And the Medrash says that Ayeko, that where are you, that's an Echo. God asks that in a mourning tone, in a tone of loss. That beauty, that integrity, that synthesis which you used to have, Adam, Ayeka, it's gone, it's lost. And God mourns that loss the same as He mourns the loss later on of Yerushalayim and the Beis Hamikdash. Tisha B'Av is God mourning, it's not us mourning. That's what the importance of this Medrash is. This is the Ribbono Shel Olam looking at us and saying, a nation with such potential, just remember what you used to be. Ayeka, where are you? What's happened to you? Can't you pull yourself together again? Can't you get yourself back to where you were? And what's the essence of where you were that's represented by the Beis HaMikdash? The Beis HaMikdash, after all, is that same kind of integration of taking the Mizbeach. What is the Mizbeach? What is an altar? Taking the animal and elevating it. Bringing it into the Beis HaMikdash, as we discussed some weeks ago. Not leaving it outside. Taking the animal, the most... A slaughterhouse is the most material place you can imagine, the most... And apart from the shochtim, apart from Jewish slaughterers who are usually Bnei Torah and Talmidei Chachomim, slaughterers are the bottom of society. A slaughterhouse, carcasses lying all over the place. You don't identify that with a place of worship. Think Lahavdil of these magnificent cathedrals and temples all over the world. And imagine bringing carcasses, dead animals with blood all over the place into them. Who would do such a thing? These places of such beauty. And into our Beis HaMikdash, the most beautiful place of worship in the entire world, what do we bring in there? Every day, hordes of animals. And we slaughter them, and there's the blood and everything that goes with it. What's it all for? To show you can't keep that. That's part of life. And that's meant to be brought into the holy places, into the Kedusha of the Beis HaMikdash. And there it's meant to be elevated. It's back to that synthesis. And in losing the Beis HaMikdash, the Jewish people lose that ability to synthesize. They lose that ability to take the material and to take the animal and to take the spiritual and the emotional and the intellectual and bind it all together in one unit that functions intuitively in just the way it functions intellectually, that functions practically in exactly the way as it functions emotionally, that there's one principle, that there's one unit, that there's one integrated whole. That's the loss that God mourns. And that's the loss that God mourned right at the beginning of creation when He created this integrated human being, and the human being set himself on a path of tensions, of conflicts that God didn't design him for. And so in understanding Tisha B'Av, it's important to understand not only the national loss of the Beis HaMikdash, but our own loss. What are we capable of? Where could we be and where are we? And to understand that, not to settle with who we are and what we are. That's when progress stops. That's when growth stops. And we look around, as I said, we do today in a national sense, and we say, gee, Torah is doing wonderfully. There are more people studying Torah now than there were before the war. I'm not sure if that's true or not. But one thing is for sure. The kind of Torah that those people are studying today is not the same kind of Torah that was being studied before the war. If we look around very self-satisfiedly, and we feel a sense of satisfaction, then there's no place for Tisha B'Av. If we look at the status of the Jewish people and we say we're doing just fine, there's no place for Tisha B'Av. Likewise, if we look at ourselves and we think that we're doing pretty well, we're fulfilling our potential, there's no place for Tisha B'Av. What we have to look at, the essence of Tisha B'Av, is Eicha or Ayeka. Where are you? That's the question of Tisha B'Av. Ayeka, where are you? And to realize that that question is being asked by God, not just by you. And your fasting and your mourning on Tisha B'Av is your sympathizing with God's mourning. Because God looks at you and says, and God looks at me and says, Ayeka, where are you and where could you be? And God bursts into tears when he sees that gap. And where are we and where could we be? We don't have any clue of the potential of the human being. Perhaps the sad part of it is that we're seeing it expressed in technology. Technologically, we see evolution taking place. What's happening now in technology is what the Torah describes morally. That Adam, Misof HaOlam Vad Sofer, that Adam HaRishon could absorb and have impact from one end of the world to the other. You look at communications today. You look at the human being's capacity to communicate internationally, universally, never mind internationally, to communicate over thousands, hundreds of thousands of miles into the universe using satellites. Our ability to extend far beyond ourselves, it's something totally mind-boggling. But that's a technological ability. It's not we who can extend that way. It's our computers and our modems and our satellites that can do it. It's not the human being. When Adam was created, Adam could do it. The human being had that capacity. He didn't need the computer. He didn't need the satellite. He didn't need the modem. He could communicate by the power of his mind and his intellect. He could communicate across light years. Today it's true. Man can do it, but it's not really man that can do it. Man has created implements. He's created tools that can do it. We've often talked about the difference. People say we're developing and technology is developing and so on, but is the man developing? You look at the pilot of the new Airbus and you think, incredible. You walk into his cockpit and there are hardly any buttons anymore. It's quite a boring looking place. There's not even a wheel to it. There's nothing to do. He sits there and you marvel, but what are you marveling at? At the technology. I mean, I told you the story, it was so delightful, but it teaches so much. I was proudly took my child into the cockpit once when we were traveling to Israel and we were over the Mediterranean. And we're looking around and flying and he's telling her all the buttons and what they do, very proud of his technology. And she looks out of the window and she sees some land out there and she says, what's that? So he looks out and he looks a little puzzled and he pulls out his maps and he starts looking and he says, that's Turkey. And I see he's still puzzled and he's still looking on his maps, and about 5 minutes later, after the co-pilot's now taking her around and showing everything, he says, no, it's not Turkey, it's Greece. So then I interrupted and I said, excuse me, are you telling me that you don't know whether that's Turkey or Greece and you're flying us? He said, I can tell you down to a meter where I'm going to put this plane down and at what time. I can tell you on what runway and exactly on what point on that runway. He said, I'll show you on a map and I'll show you exactly on what point to an accuracy of 1 meter. But if you ask me what that is out there, I don't know. I don't need to know. So what is growing? Compare that to the old navigators. Imagine you would have asked an old navigator used to look at the star through his instruments there and try and work out where he was. If you saw land and said, what's that? Would he say, Greece, Turkey, don't know? He would have had the intuitive knowledge of knowing where he was. We've developed technology to do what human beings can no longer do. That's what's happening. The advance of technology parallels the decline of the human being. We're developing computers to communicate because human beings have forgotten how to communicate. We've developed computer programs to do spell checks because human beings have forgotten how to spell. We've developed word processors that can correct the grammar because human beings don't know how to read. We've covered up for all the incapacities that the human mind and intellect has developed, and they call it evolution, they call it development. It's not the development of the human being. The human being is becoming more and more incapacitated. Thank goodness there are affirmative action programs. Soon we'll all be candidates for affirmative action because we'll all be incapacitated. We'll all be disadvantaged. And therefore we'll have a right to all sorts of opportunities as a result of that, because we'll be totally incapable of doing anything. But that's where the human being is going. That's what the human being is developing into, an incapacitated being. And he's substituting his incapacity with marvels of technology. Absolute marvels of technology. But it's the technology that's progressing, and we must never confuse that and think that mankind is progressing. Mankind isn't progressing at all. Mankind is on a decline. That's what Tisha B'Av's all about. Tisha B'Av looks at the computer and says, that's where you used to be, and look at you now. Tisha B'Av looks at the spell check and says, you used to be able to do that all by yourself, now you need a computer. Tisha B'Av looks at a satellite and says, you could communicate out there yourself with your mind, and now you need all this to do it, because you can do nothing, because you're completely incapacitated. That's what Tisha B'Av's all about. And where does that come from, the capacity of the human being to do things, and why have we lost it? There's the lovely story in the Chumash of Yaakov coming to running away from Esav, and he goes out to his uncle Lavan. Remember, he comes to the well, and there's this enormous stone covering the well, and all the shepherds used to gather together so that they could roll up this enormous stone off the well. It wasn't something that any one person could do, or two or three. It needed a team of shepherds, and the shepherds of old were giborim. They were like rugby players nowadays. They had power. And you needed a whole team of them to move the stone. And when Yaakov sees Rivka, when Yaakov sees Rachel coming along, he moves it, and the Chazal say, like removing a cork off a bottle. And with one hand, he pushes it aside. And that's reflected in the piyutim that we say when we daven for Geshem on Shemini Atzeres. We say, Yichaed lev v'golal evin b'pi ba'er mayim. Referring to Yaakov, we say he applied his mind, yicheid lev, and that comes from the word echod, chad. He sharpened his mind, he applied his mind, but most important of all, echod, he integrated himself and applied all of his powers to one purpose, and that was the removal of the stone. When all of the human being is focused on one purpose, there is no limit to what that human being can do. It's back to the integration of the human ability, and that's what Adam HaRishon lost. And what has only momentarily been recovered by particular individuals at particular times. Adam HaRishon could do anything, because Adam HaRishon was integrated. That integration of all his different capacities allowed him to do and to achieve whatever he applied himself to. Once the human being became separated, and the instinct wants one thing, and the emotions want something else, and the mind wants a third thing, and all of that is divided up, our emotions are themselves not integrated. We've got mixed emotions. Our emotions are all pulling in different ways, and our instincts are all pulling in different ways, and our mind is pulling in all sorts of different ways. What can the human being do? He can't do anything at all. That's when he becomes incapacitated. So that the whole Tisha B'Av process is that process of disintegration, the process of splitting, tying that belt around him. When Adam put that belt on, that was the beginning of the end. That was the point at the beginning of the decline of man, when that integrity was lost. And man was challenged now to try and wreak. Yaakov did it when he met Rachel at the well. And there are other cases where it's done. There's a Reb Chaim brings a beautiful Rashi in Shmos, where God says to the plague of Shechin of boils. God says to Moshe, take two handfuls of ash from the ovens, and Moshe must throw it up to the heavens in the eyes of Paro, and it will become dust over the whole land of Egypt, and it will cause shechin, it will cause these boils all over the place. Says Rashi, kol dover hanizrak b'koyach eino nizrak ela b'yad achas. If you're going to throw something forcefully, you do it with one hand, not with two. So that's already interesting. You see the concept of integrity. Two hands can't throw as forcefully as one hand. Two hands should be able to throw twice as forcefully as one hand. But one hand has an advantage that two hands don't. It has integrity. It's not divided. When it's a unity, when the unit is one, it can do much more than when they're together. But Rashi goes on to say, "Harei nisim b'harbe." There were many miracles. Echod, the first miracle is Shechezek kumtzo shel Moshe maloichos naim shelo v'shel Aaron. God told Moshe and Aaron both to take a double handful of ash, And Moshe's one hand could contain the ashes of both of them. That's miracle number one. Be'echo, the second miracle, Sheholacha Ova Kalkol Eretz Mitzrayim, that the dust went out and flew over the whole of Egypt. Also, Chaim Shmulev, it's based on the Sifsei Chachomim also. What about the miracle of throwing it up to heaven? It says that he threw it up, Uzerokom Moshe Hashomaima. Vayizrok Oiso Moshe Hashomaima, and Moshe threw it up to heaven. Didn't just throw it up. You try throwing up ash, see how high it goes. Doesn't say he threw it into the air. He says it threw it up to heaven. Why is that not mentioned as a miracle? Explains of Chaim Shmulev, because that's a function of strength. That's not the miracle. The miracle is that it multiplied. The miracle is that it covered the whole land of Egypt, because no amount of strength can convert one handful of ash into enough to cover the whole land of Egypt. But to throw it up to heaven, no big deal. That just needs strength. So you say, but the human beings don't have such strength. Says Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz, but if you apply yourself, you can have that strength. That's not a miracle. That's called exceptional strength. Amazing application. Enormous dedication to the cause. Call it what you want, but it's not a miracle yet. Anything that the human being can achieve through his own strength, no matter how supernatural that strength might be, that's not called a miracle yet. Because that's, so to say, within the capacity of the human being. There's hardly anything that isn't within the capacity of the human being if he really tries. We have the same concept morally, where the Gemara says that if you've got a rosha, if you've got a wicked man standing under a chuppah and he's about to get married and he gives the ring to his wife and the rabbi says, say after me, but this is a wicked man who's learnt a little bit, he's a bit of a Talmid Chochem as well, which is not a contradiction in terms, and he says, Hare at, the rabbi says, Hare at, you are, and he says, you are mekudeshes li, that you are dedicated to me as my wife with this ring, and he adds, B'tnai she'ani tzaddik. There's a condition to this marriage. That's that I'm a tzaddik. If I'm a tzaddik, you're my wife. If I'm not a tzaddik, you're not my wife. Now what do you do? Is he a tzaddik? Isn't he a tzaddik? Who knows? How do you decide whether the man's a tzaddik? And this has now legal ramifications. Is she married or isn't she? Is she a married woman or is she single? Does she need a get? Does she need a divorce from him? Or doesn't she need a divorce from him? We've got to decide, did that marriage technically take place or didn't it? The Gemara says, Harei Mekudesh, she is. She'ema hirer b'tshuva. We can assume that he did tshuva at that moment. The Lecha Mishnah asks in the name of the Maran Padva, well, that's not consistent with another halacha. What happens if you marry somebody, same case, Hareyat Mekudeshes, you give the woman the ring in front of two witnesses as you have to do, but the two witnesses are Rishoyim, they're wicked people. Then they're not kosher witnesses. If they're not kosher witnesses, the marriage is null and void. It's as if the marriage didn't take place. Asks the Maran Padva, why don't we say maybe the witnesses did tshuva, maybe the witnesses did repent, and maybe they were tzaddikim? Why do we assume that the witnesses have remained wicked, whereas when the man gives the ring, we say, no, maybe he did tshuva, maybe he repented? Explains the Lecha Mishnah, because the witnesses did and said nothing. There's no reason to think that they changed anything. The man at least said, I'm marrying her on the understanding that I'm a tzaddik. The word tzaddik at least came out of his mouth. He's thinking in that sense. But what's interesting is that you can take a man who's had no, he's a wicked guy, has had no indication of any desire to be anything but a wicked man, and in 1 second it's possible for him to qualify as a tzaddik. In 1 second that can happen. There is no limit to what the human being is capable of. Because the human being was created with that limitlessness, because the human being was created with that total integrity of his mind, of his heart, and of his instinct, and with that integrity he can achieve anything. Because he was created that way, that is his potential. And to get there doesn't necessarily take years and years of education. To get there doesn't necessarily take training and all sorts of things and maturity. To get there can take a moment. To get there, just as communication to these outer reaches, as we were talking about, doesn't take a long time. Within milliseconds, you can get your message thousands and hundreds of thousands of miles across the universe. So within milliseconds, a person can make a moral journey of light years as well. A person can make a religious journey of light years as well. A person can take all those different powers that he has, all those different strengths that he has that are pulling him in all these different directions, and he can be yiched lev as Yaakov did. He can bring them all together in an integrated whole. He can dedicate them and focus them in one direction, on one object, in one purpose. And with that, there is no limit to what he can achieve. He can momentarily get himself back, so to say, to the levels of Adam HaRishon. Only if we know that is there meaning in Tisha B'Av and the 9 days. Only if we know Ayeko, where we are. And knowing where we are implies that we know where we came from. Because that's the frame of reference. Where you are is only important in its relationship to where you came from. Only if we recognize where we are and where we came from, that as a nation we come from Yerushalayim with the Beis Hamikdash. We come from the time of Shlomo HaMelech. We come from Avram, from Yitzchok, from Yaakov. We come from Moshe and Aaron. Only if we realize that does the process have any kind of meaning, because that's where we could get back to. Only if we realize that we come from Odom HaRishon, that we come from a human being who was totally integrated, and with that integration and with that integrity, he was Mesofa Ilom Bad Sofo, he was able to grasp and to impact on the entire universe. Only if we realize that that's where we come from, does the process of Tisha B'Av and the 9 days have meaning. And that's what we're meant to do. Those feelings that should lead us not to be having meat is the feeling of, if only I could be where I could be. If only I were where I could be. The gap is so great that to sit and eat meat and drink wine and have parties at this time, this at least now, let me understand. And when it comes to Tisha B'Av, when we stop eating altogether, the same process. And really, that's something we should be doing all the time. If we really understand the gap of where we've come from and where we are, we wouldn't want to eat at all. We wouldn't want to celebrate at all. That would be wrong. Because if we stopped celebrating and we stopped eating and we stopped living and engaging, we would never get back to where we're supposed to be. So once a year, God allows us to dwell on that gap. Once a year, God allows us to take a jolly good look at Ayeko. Once a year, God allows us to hear His sob and to see His tears and to cry together with Him.